Can I welcome you all to this very special event? It's a very special event in the Mansfield College calendar. My name is Helena Kennedy and I'm the principal of Mansfield College. And I should tell you all that I'm a fresher. I'm a fresher because I'm a new principal and I only came to Mansfield last autumn. My background is as a leading criminal lawyer and Queen's Counsel at the Bar. And in fact, many people have asked the question, why would an Oxford College choose a criminal lawyer as its head of house? But as you all know from Inspector Morse, murders happen in Oxford on a weekly basis, so I'm very well placed. Mansfield College, for those of you who know it, and some of you won't, is a small college, but it has a wonderful history. Until the late 19th century, to join an Oxford College, you had to be a member of the Church of England to sign up to the 39 Articles. So it meant that those who were Jews or Catholics or nonconformists couldn't study at one of the colleges. And happily, that all changed. And today we can proudly say that here in Oxford, we are a very diverse place with students from all traditions and backgrounds. But then it was different. Mansfield College had originally been in Birmingham, and it came into being here in Oxford in the 19th century. It was the Dissenters' College, a place where those of the dissenting tradition could be educated to become ordinands in the first instance. Many were worker priests in the valleys of Wales and in the factory towns in the north, Presbyterian ministers in Scotland, and all of them kept then a watchful eye for the talented, the bright and the best young men, as it was then, in their towns and villages who might have the opportunity of an Oxford education. There's a healthy intellectual tradition of dissent in Britain. Indeed, it brought democracy into this country. And indeed, it's kept our democracy strong. It was the tradition which, in fact, gave us our civil liberties and our human rights, a field in which I've spent my life working. Debate and the contest of ideas is at the heart of that dissenting tradition. And it remains a powerful part of Mansfield's ethos. And this Hands lecture adds to that culture of challenging debate. Why the Hands lecture? Well, as a college, we owe much to the generosity of one of our alumni, the financier Guy Hands. It's Guy's generosity that has helped us to develop on many fronts, helping us to build a hall of residence for some of our students. He's helped us develop our Access to Excellence campaign, which enables us and has done for many, many years to develop an access program. And that's built on our beliefs, again, rooted firmly in that dissenting tradition, that an Oxford education should be available to all those with the requisite talent and a potential to benefit from it, whatever their background. As a result, Mansfield, with its high proportion of students, 84% from the state sector and from groups that have hitherto been underrepresented at Oxford, it probably means that it has the most socially diverse student population of any of the Oxford colleges. And that's something of which we're proud and to which we owe a great deal of gratitude to Guy. In order to show our appreciation to Guy Hands and his wife Julia for their generosity, the college in 2001 inaugurated an annual series of Hands lectures at which eminent speakers are invited to speak on topics of major socio-political significance of their own choosing. It started off in 2001 with David Blunkett speaking about education and access and widening participation. It went on the following year where we had Malcolm Rifkind, then we followed with Lord Goldsmith, then in 2004 Sir Nigel Wicks, 2005 Shami Chakrabarty, in 2006 Sir Jeremy Greenstock, 2007 President Jimmy Carter, in 2008 Lord Ashdown, Paddy, in 2010 Sir Alan Langlands, and then here now, the Right Honourable Lord Peter Mandelson. Peter is familiar probably to everybody in this hall because he's been so much part of our firmament. It was he who was a key architect in the repositioning of the Labour Party as New Labour and its subsequent landslide victory in 1997 in that general election played a great part, relied a great part on the role that he played. He was in government and served in a number of cabinet positions, but really where he was perhaps most glorious was as the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry. It's rare to meet a businessman who doesn't say what an exceptional cabinet minister he was in that role. He went on from there, having left Parliament, to become the European Commissioner for Trade, and was there at the heart of Europe from 2004 to 2008. He rejoined the British government when he was made a life peer by the Queen and took his seat in the House of Lords on the 13th of October 2008 and was a front bench spokesman. I have known Peter Mandelson indeed since we were really very young. I knew him in his pre-New Labour manifestation when he worked in television. We have been good friends for many years. In fact, I'm one of the people who knows a secret about Peter Mandelson, that he occupied this examination hall when he was a student in the 70s. He had a very radical past. At the 2001 general election, he is remembered for making an exuberant acceptance speech when he was re-elected by a very large majority. And he said then, "I'm a fighter and not a quitter," and referred to his inner steel. No one has doubted his inner steel. He's known for that steel, but also for his charm, his political skill, his breadth of political knowledge, and his willingness, occasionally, to be controversial. Who better to give the Mansfield College Hands Lecture? I ask you to welcome the Right Honourable Lord Mandelson.
Well, Helena, your excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I have re-entered the examination schools with some trepidation because this was the scene not only of my revolutionary occupation at the end of my first term after I'd come up to St. Catherine's. I remember we came in, we slept overnight. I sort of slept sort of over there, roughly where David Marquand is, just there with a sleeping bag that I had bought from home, and woke up the next day to read in the Daily Telegraph the immortal observation of Lady Alexandra Trevor Roper, who said that she had observed the occupation of the examination schools, but couldn't believe that they were members of the university because they all seemed to be wearing dirty jerseys. But I'm afraid this was also the scene, and it's why I have a sort of particularly nervous knot in my stomach. This was also the scene of my, at the end of my first year, of my failed politics prelim. Would you believe it? It was a good grounding for my future political career. It's always good to be introduced to failure at an early stage. But it is a great pleasure to deliver this lecture, partly because, obviously it's not easy to say no to Helena Kennedy, as I have discovered throughout our long friendship. But also because it's nice to deliver a lecture in the name of somebody I have known and admired, Guy Hans, for over 10 years. He's actually rather more than a financier. He is a very serious entrepreneur of the sort that we need more of in this country. But he's also a very thoughtful and a creative individual and a great conversationalist. And it's why I've always enjoyed our friendship. Now, I'm going to deliver a lecture on the subject, the title that was given to me by Guy and Helena, which is Europe, Is It the End of the Project? I want to talk tonight, therefore, about the future of the European Union. I'm not going to delve deeply into the solution for the Eurozone crisis, or the merits of euro bonds or a more activist role for the ECB. There are people better equipped than I to talk about that. But what I want to do is to set out why I think the European project and what I would describe as a Eurozone Mark II are worth saving. I also want to set out why I think saving the euro is going to pose a serious problem for Britain, precisely because, quite rightly, British policy is to save it by deepening the integration of the Eurozone core. Now, I recognise, and I want to say at the start, that there are a lot of people out there betting emotionally, politically, even literally in the Mayfair hedge fund community, on the failure of the Eurozone. I share some of their worries, I share some of their scepticism. But tonight I want to debate the costs and the consequences, not of failure, but of success. In the 2 years since the British people liberated me from office and gave me the opportunity to spend more time with my iPad, I have travelled a great deal in Europe and beyond, probably even more beyond. And I've been lucky enough to talk to a lot of heads of government, of ministers, of academics, business CEOs and the like. And their views and insights have informed much of what I want to say in my lecture this evening. It has struck me over the last 6 months or so, and especially after last December's European Council, that when you try to engage in this debate about the future of Europe outside Britain, even as a pro-European former commissioner like myself, people barely disguise their view that this is not really a debate in which a British perspective will actually account for very much. And that, I think, is a sign of where I believe we are headed as a country, which is part of what I want to speak about tonight. The sense that last December, when the Prime Minister cast Britain's veto, Britain made a profound choice to remain in Europe, but on detached terms. Nevertheless, for the first part of my lecture tonight, I want to speak as a European. And when I talk about we, I mean all of us in the European Union. When I say European, I mean Britons as well. In the second half of the lecture, I will talk more directly about the particular British problem in Europe. But in both cases, I want to start with Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill's famous speech in Zurich in 1946, defending the idea of a United States of Europe, is often invoked in continental Europe as evidence that there is British intellectual DNA at the heart of the idea of the European Union. But of course, Churchill was far from clear that Britain actually belonged in this United States of Europe. Churchill, like many of his contemporaries, including his successor, Anthony Eden, believed Britain was an empire in its own right, not part of someone else's. It had no business in the management of Belgium's coal reserves. It is an interesting historical fact that Churchill belonged to the last generation of senior conservatives until those in power now, who would hold these two particular views at the same time, that closer political integration among a core of European states was a necessary thing, but that Britain should have no part of it. Now, I want to come back to that point later, because it's, in my view, fundamental to our understanding of what is going on. Everything about Britain's relationship with the European Union since that time has been marked by varying degrees of ambivalence, Labour and Tory. My own grandfather, Herbert Morrison, acting as Prime Minister during Attlee's illness in 1950, decided against Britain going into the coal and steel community because, as he remarked to officials at the time, and I quote, "the Durham miners wouldn't wear it." But as it became clear that the post-war Churchillian vision of Britain was increasingly unrealistic, the view of what was happening politically on the continent became both more complicated and more attractive. Harold Macmillan fretted endlessly in his diary that if a united Europe was established without Britain, we would end up with a German-dominated Europe, that in the 20th century we had fought two world wars to prevent. Ironically, of course, today, it is probably Germany that is doing the most fretting about a German-dominated Europe. But again, back to that in a moment. Clearly, Britain could not join the United States of Europe. But there were other rationales for cooperation. And what emerged in both Conservative and Labour minds was a very clear and compelling economic case for joining a united markets of Europe. In any event, the reasoning in London was, and in Foreign and Commonwealth Office circles still very much is, that Britain must shape this process from the inside. And so eventually, in we went. And through the 80s and the 1990s, Britain was an intellectual driver of the liberalisation of the single market at the heart of the European Union. Certainly, Britain's welcome liberal attitude to the single market has left a far deeper, I would say, indelible impression on the European Commission than is generally recognised in this country. But European states and European voters have never really been explicitly confronted with the need to choose between a more pragmatic European economic union and the idea that it might evolve into a single political community. The fudge on monetary union that gave Europe a currency but not the fiscal institutions to manage its underlying economic foundations is, in my view, a symptom of this problem. Britain signed up to membership in Europe. The language is interesting and suggestive. Membership implies being able to sort of come and go as you please, and indeed leave the club, should you wish. Now, Illinois and Texas do not describe themselves as members of the United States. The community formally, of course, became a union in 1991 with Maastricht, a change of name with nothing more than the flourish of a pen. Now, we've got to a point where the political classes are solving the Eurozone crisis on the op-ed pages of the Financial Times about two or three times a week. And no doubt there are students in this audience who are doing the same in their weekly tutorials. But we are better at saying how to fix the Eurozone than why, and for what higher purpose. And I don't mean why in the short term the costs of failure are higher than the costs of fixing it sense. I mean, why have a Eurozone at all in the 21st century? Why have a European Union at all? What is it exactly we are intent on preserving and for what purpose? Now, back in the 1970s, I cut my campaigning teeth as an undergraduate here in Oxford in Britain's European referendum. Then, to be pro-European in the UK was about defending a growing single market. It was a rejection of centuries of European interstate conflict, and yes, also a rejection of British parochialism. This impulse was and is very powerful, still in many parts of continental Europe. Indeed, it is one of the two basic drivers of the European Union over the first half century of its life. It sees the EU, above all, as redemption, an antidote to Europe's past, and the politics of European Union as fundamentally being about transcending the nationalism that has scarred our continent and national politics in the name of a bigger, better European common good. In the 1980s and 1990s, a new and different set of liberal economic arguments then took centre stage. A network of dozens of exchange rates and divergent national regulations is an impediment to trade and economies of scale. And the widening and deepening of the European market gave British advocates of open trade and free markets, in particular, a strong case for a particular version of the European Union, including one based on a form of monetary union. So we have two trajectories that have driven the development, the growth of the European Union. That of the more political euro redeemers, and on the other hand, the more economic euro marketeers. But both of these trajectories have actually become weaker and less potent with time. The wars are ancient history. The external Soviet threat that provided such a strong external pressure on European unity, that's gone. Or at least has all these things morphed out of all recognition into a very real but much less tangible sort of global competitiveness challenge that we face now in the world, but not quite as real and not quite as threatening and tangible as the original threats that drove European unity. And a lot of the basic economic and practical advantages of closer integration also are no longer seen as linked to any real sort of political project. A generation of younger Europeans have simply banked the single market, the ease of passport-free travel. They do not see these things as being necessarily contingent on fiscal governance in Brussels or common debt liability underwritten in Frankfurt. And they are right. These are two different visions of the European Union, and I think it would be better to be honest about that. Every time we try to explain the EU just in terms of these new conveniences of modern European life, we are actually fudging the matter. Because Europe chose a single currency, and the decision to move into currency union is now demanding a version of the European Union, which is based on far more than the conveniences of modern life. It's based on real collective fiscal governance, something much more akin to a political union than we have openly acknowledged or debated up until now. Europe can no doubt continue to sort of muddle through for some years to come as we steer through the next banking crisis or debt market panic. But a credible future for the Eurozone and the basis of a Eurozone Mark II will have to rest on some degree of fiscal federalism amongst its members. The German Chancellor, who obviously holds the checkbook at this point, has been clear about that, and she's absolutely right. To survive, the Eurozone needs to operate more as a single political entity. Now, so far in the Eurozone crisis, we have seen more reciprocity than anyone probably thought possible, but it has not proven so far enough reciprocity actually to save the system. And that's why we have to think much more broadly and much more long-term if we want to see the survival of the Eurozone. Whether what is ultimately enough falls short of full fiscal union, we will see. But we know for sure that it must involve a huge new step in integration. The passing over to collective decision-making areas regarded as deeply sovereign, tax and spending levels, policy coordination, fiscal transfers, banking supervision and regulation. Just witness the arguments in Brussels this week between our own Chancellor and Commissioner Barnier. Now, I think this is the inevitable course for the Eurozone to take, and that it will probably work economically if these steps are taken. My question, though, is this: whether it is sustainable, not economically, but politically, especially in a period of profound austerity, and whether the European public will understand why it is right to sign up to such an advance in federalism, and will be actually willing to do so. As we are already starting to see, German largesse will not feel anything quite like solidarity on the streets of Athens and Madrid. And in Germany itself and other surplus countries, this solidarity with Greece and Spain and Portugal and Italy may actually start to look excessive and politically unsustainable. So it is the politics of the future of the Eurozone, in my view, which are actually as important as the economics. Now, it may be that Eurozone citizens are more accepting of the new arrangements than I imagine. But it seems to me that we will never genuinely secure the legitimacy of this step without a much clearer sense among Europeans of why we should be arranging our affairs in this way in the 21st century. We need a justification. We need people to get up and explain why and not just how. So what is the case for the EU? I think Europeans understand and accept much of the case for closer cooperation. They see the link between collaboration and their current prosperity and security. The disfiguring of Europe by fascism and authoritarianism has given way to a community of states collectively bound to the world's highest standards of political openness and civil protection, and with one of the highest standards of living, by the way, of anywhere in the world. In this respect, the EU is arguably the most effective foreign policy the world has ever seen. Its soft power, immense, conducted by an effective High Representative. Although Europeans are still ambivalent about many aspects of economic globalization, we accept the value of rationalising our economic relations through the single market, a common trade policy as well. We accept that the single market requires quite a high level of regulatory convergence in order to be effective, and that this means pooling sovereign decisions in areas such as competition policy and consumer protection, as well as trade. We increasingly, I believe, will come to see not just the value, but the necessity of rationalising our energy use through a more integrated single market in energy and approach to developing alternative energy technologies. We get that we have an unstable regional neighbourhood as well, and unstable it is, which is also a big argument for close foreign and security policy cooperation. A complicated relationship at the other end of our continent with Russia, an unpredictable Iran, and a North Africa that is being transformed in exciting but potentially destabilizing ways. In all of these cases, we have a long and porous border. Now, we know that our ability to exercise diplomatic influence in any of these areas depends to a great extent on our unity. It is certainly immeasurably greater when we can bring the collective weight of the European Union to bear. Around the world, doors are open to José Manuel Barroso, the Commission President, because the European Commission's decisions matter to the big global players in the world. As EU Trade Commissioner, I exercised influence in China or with the United States or in the WTO only because I represented a combined market of 500 million people. When the use of military force is required on any significant scale, as it was in Libya, even the largest European militaries can exercise power only in coordination, and at this stage, without the support of the US, barely at all. Now, these are compelling arguments for a single European policy in these and other areas. While I think most Europeans accept them, here in Britain we have often lost sight of them. At the time of the 1975 referendum, it was obvious, even to Mrs. Thatcher, that as the empire disappeared and as the Commonwealth evolved, our influence in the world would be sustained and multiplied through Europe. Europe could be seen not as a sacrifice of sovereignty, but a mutually beneficial pooling of it. For me and the great majority of Europeans, it is simply delusional to think that a reversion to a fragmented Europe of relatively small, and I mean small, uncoordinated national states and national markets would be anything other than a backward step. And that logic applies unequivocally to Britain as well. I think that if the EU did not exist, we would want to invent it. Not perhaps exactly what we have today, but something very much like it. Now, the more difficult question, though, is whether this set of common interests and this case for cooperation and coordination is the basis for a single European polity. Does it make us a real political community as opposed to a community of interests? I don't think there is a single simple answer, actually, to that question. Can we speak of a single political unit called Europe? Clearly, we have a common history full of unifying and fragmentary impulses. I think we can speak of European values, of a broad European consensus on political protection, for example, of personal rights, of the secularism of political life, a European way of managing personal and social economic insecurity through a combination of open markets and social protections. These ideas make us an intellectual and policy community. not a closed or impermeable one, but one whose hinterland is clearly the European continent and these islands that we live on. But do they make us a single political community? Well, to a degree. Do we identify with each other as Europeans? To a degree. Perhaps more importantly, do we feel solidarity with each other? Well, again, to a degree. Now, I think we might say that whatever the words in the treaty, we do feel like a broad community. We are more ambiguous at this stage, though, about the idea of union. But what is being contemplated now to secure the future of economic and monetary integration in Europe is a very big step in that rather ambiguous direction. Fiscal union will, of course, not erase national or regional identities or the critical role of national government in our lives, but it is by far the largest measure of sovereignty that European leaders have so far contemplated collectivising. And by its nature, it means transfers from one member state to another, something which requires unprecedented solidarity. And what is currently being planned by the European Commission is the reprogramming and deployment of community resources across the Eurozone's periphery that dwarfs the post-war Marshall Fund many, many times over. This is an order of magnitude greater politically, I have to say, than the current structural funds. Now, that is, in my view, the right course of action to take. But if that political case is going to be made and won, it will require clear justification and defence. From politicians in Germany, it will require an acceptance that the badly designed Eurozone has brought substantial benefits for Germany in the form of suppressed exchange rates and a massive export surplus, and that bearing the bulk of the cost of correcting the Eurozone's deep imbalances is an acceptable compromise for Germany to make. From politicians in Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, and Ireland, it will require the courage and discipline to present both painful austerity and structural economic and market reforms for what they are, not something that is externally imposed by Brussels or Berlin, but as a sovereign choice dictated not by outsiders, but by national circumstance and necessity. Otherwise, the EU risks becoming defined in the minds of citizens simply with bailouts and fiscal discipline, a sort of a resentment union, a kind of European IMF. And the governance of the EU is going to need to change too. I believe that the current Commission should be shrunk and its working methods merged more with the Council to form a full governing board, which includes every member state, and a smaller executive committee of the EU, rather than on the model of the governance of the European Central Bank. The status of the European Commission needs to be reasserted to reflect its important new responsibilities in relation to the Eurozone's economic governance, but also to protect the interests of those within the EU but outside the Eurozone. I'm also struck by the number of people arguing for a renewed role for national parliamentarians in Brussels alongside the European Parliament, not least because so many aspects of economic governance, like education, industrial policy, and scientific research, are national responsibilities whilst being essential to Europe's overall economic performance. I also think the case is growing for electing the personality who leads Europe's governance, either directly by the public across the European Union or indirectly through the European Union, through the European Parliament. But from our point of view in Britain, these detailed arrangements may be a secondary question. Assuming that this major advance in the Eurozone does take place, then we will have something more akin to a European Union within a European community. A Eurozone that will see itself increasingly and be seen by others as core Europe, and then an outer ring of states either actively working towards eventual membership of the Eurozone or simply outside it as a matter of policy and politics. Now, what are the implications then for Britain of this? For 30 years, UK European policy has been based on the principle of supporting the widening of the EU as a check on its deepening. In reality, we can see now that the creation of economic and monetary union in the 90s probably meant that this policy was living on borrowed time. The UK government itself now argues that the Eurozone's future depends on it following the logic of fiscal and political integration. George Osborne calls this the Eurozone's inexorable logic. Like Churchill in 1946, we have a government that is urging on the unifiers whilst placing ourselves outside the circle. Now, I believe there will be an inevitable gravitational pull of decision-making towards the inner Eurozone core. Britain will be invited to support this evolution, but if we refuse, we're going to simply to be ignored. In effect, this is what happened in December at the European Council. As President Sarkozy put it bluntly, but with absolute precision, quote, "We want you to come with us, but we're not going to pay you to do so." Now, in the years to come, Britain will be faced with a recurring choice of roads to follow. The one of joining with the core, and the other of permanent second-tier status. Life in a sort of European annex for us. It is certainly not inconceivable, indeed I think it is likely, that Britain will find itself a decade from now the only state in the European Union, certainly the only large state, outside the Eurozone. Effectively, the European Union will have been rebooted with the UK on the outside. Now, we must not delude ourselves, in my view, about this. At many practical levels, this may not matter too much, not least in the short to medium term. Cooperation on defence, foreign, or energy policy will have their own centres of gravity that will not actually be anchored in the Eurozone. But for the running of the single market, by any measure, the most important feature, and certainly the most important opportunity for us in Britain, the implications are obviously potentially serious, as the core group increasingly caucus on matters of economic governance without us. There is already an active debate in Germany and France about the new political institutional arrangements that need to be developed at the Eurozone level to ensure cohesion and legitimacy. France has long wanted separate institutions for the Eurozone core and was therefore rather pleased when Britain's veto seemed to make this inevitable in December. Germany, on the other hand, will resist that. But bluntly, who will care that much about the interests of the community of 27 or 28, as it will be, if all but Britain actually belong to the tighter inner core? Not now, not next year, but eventually. Now, as is our way in Britain, we will continue to frame the questions in practical rather than political terms. Can a major financial centre like London exist in the single market but outside the currency union, given that securing the European banking system will need to be done collectively within the Eurozone? Can we build more alliances with the Scandinavians and the Eastern Europeans, who are probably closest to our political outlook, if they're in and we're out? But ultimately, the higher question may be about politics and identity. Our own history as Europeans is complex and difficult. The English Channel is a psychological phenomenon as well as a body of water. We have long tried to believe that the EU would keep getting wider rather than deeper, as I said, and that we would never have to confront our own ambiguous feelings about union. Now, events are conspiring to call our bluff. And for us in Britain, this will pose a sharp, for some deeply uncomfortable, choice that we have hoped and sought to avoid. A nation of reluctant Europeans will have to confront a choice between taking part in a greater integration, including joining the Euro, or resigning ourselves to a very much more uncertain future in Europe. Having posed the problem thus, I don't think I can really end without some form of conclusion or prescription for Britain. I think my biggest challenge, actually, is to the pro-Europeans in the UK. In the version of the future that I have described, there are two basic ways of being out of Europe for our country. There is the argument that just says we should be out altogether. I mean, the red tape, the bent bananas, the gravy train, and all the rest. I mean, the UKIP view.
The sausages.
Sausages, for example. Cucumbers. The lot. Then there's the argument that a looser relationship, a place on the second tier, is actually fine for Britain. Not out, but not actually fully in either. A Hong Kong to Europe's China, or a Canada to Europe's United States. The second, I think, is basically where the current government, or the Conservative part of it, probably would be happy to come down. My view is that both will probably amount, in actual fact, to much the same thing. We will still have to meet EU standards to trade with Europe. We will simply have little or no voice in defining those rules and those standards. We will still seek to align ourselves with Europe internationally most of the time as a matter of political and practical necessity, but we will have a less say in Europe's own policy deliberations. For this reason, I think both outcomes seem badly flawed and should be rejected, both the completely out and the sort of half in, half out. But what is the pro argument? Is it just a version of this basic isolationism, but with more sort of positive sounding rhetoric? A belief that we should focus on being good Europeans by cooperating, for example, on defence, energy, anti-terrorism, but essentially semi-detached, and increasingly accepting that the economic terms on which the wider European market operates will actually be determined by the core simply as a function of their number and their weight? Is that really what the pro-argument is going to amount to? Or is it a Britain that ultimately accepts a stronger European political vocation? A Britain that accepts that to rule out ever joining the Euro may be, almost certainly will be, to rule out a place in the genuine European Union of the future and its successful currency union. And precisely for that reason, does not rule out joining the single currency and the inner core in principle, indeed, which anticipates possible membership. Now, Britain's Eurosceptics are busy patting themselves on the back for their historical resistance to joining the euro. But it seems to me that assuming that the eurozone is doomed to perpetual failure is actually assuming a lot. There is a strong case for a European single currency, and in practical respects, the actual currency has worked rather well. It is the currency union, the eurozone and its arrangements, that are politically and institutionally flawed, and the crisis may in fact be the key to its success by forcing the necessary institutional and political reforms to carry out the running repairs that make it function better in the future. The economic logic for staying outside the eurozone can and probably will change as the euro continues its rise to a global reserve currency. The logic for London and the euro may actually become the same. Hong Kong's strength is in large part a function of mainland China's weakness, and for all its problems, Europe hardly fits that picture. And as China grows stronger and internationalizes its currency, and Beijing and Shanghai become centers for the international trading of that currency, where actually does that leave Hong Kong, you know, Britain, in the future? Now, throughout this lecture, I've purposefully tried to be as dispassionate as possible. But I think you sort of guess where I stand in this argument. I think you may do. I believe in a prospect of euro membership and closer political union and economic governance in Europe. Partly I recognize this is an emotional choice. I identify with that future as a sort of European. But it is also because I believe that, if I can paraphrase Mrs. Thatcher, for Britain, the facts of globalized life are European. Just as irrespective of their individual strength and identity, the facts of globalized life for California or New York are American. Being part of a political and economic European Union would be, for me, a pragmatic way of asserting British values and British interests in the world. Actually, the only really credible way of asserting these values and these interests. But it is also because I believe that such a political union would take nothing of value from what matters to me, being British or English. I don't believe that my nationhood is going to be robbed and taken away from me. But I fully accept that a majority of British people don't agree with me. In fact, we do not know what the British or the individual nations of Britain, for that matter, think about the European future. But my message this evening is a wake-up call for today's generation of political, business, and trade union leaders and the non-governmental organizations, for example, who care about the environment and climate change and global poverty and what we can do as Europeans collectively about those things. The British public need to engage in these different ways at these different levels with what is at stake. The European mandate that the Heath government secured in the 1970s belongs to another time and to another generation. I believe a fresh referendum on this will be necessary because the political parties cannot reconcile their own differences and come to a final conclusion on their own, and actually, nor should they do that without reference to the British public. While the Conservative Party is the home of visceral hostility towards Europe to an extent, the truth is that negative feelings about Europe are now more present in all the political parties. And whilst a referendum should not be held as a panicky electoral response to the rise of UKIP, as I fear might be David Cameron's inclination, I believe it would not be also, it would not be relevant until the new shape of Europe and the success or otherwise of a Eurozone Mark II finally emerges and a considered judgment is possible, something which is likely to be years, certainly a fair way off from today. At that stage, in my view, a referendum would be a healthy means of re-establishing a national consensus among Britons and amongst the nations of Britain, for that matter, about Britain's place in the world and the role that Europe should play in that. Now, we need a serious debate on this. And it seems to me that the burden is now on the pro-Europeans to make the case. I don't believe that pro-European Labour and Liberal Democrats can leave it to the Conservative ultra-sceptics to make all the running over Europe, as we've seen over the last couple of decades. The Tory allergy to public debate on Europe for a decade has to some degree let Labour and the Lib Dems off the hook. Now, to get a sense of how this debate might sound, it is worth considering some polling undertaken by Populus for the think tank Policy Network, of which I am president, last weekend. Overall, two-thirds, 67% of people support staying in the European Union. A third would simply leave. But by staying, a majority of people mean doing so either in a looser free trade area or the European Union as it is, with no further integration. Now, tonight I've argued that these are not the directions Europe is going in. Therefore, it's an artificial choice for us. 80%, according to this polling, are against ever joining the single currency. Given the crisis at the moment, you wonder who the other 20% are. But 4%, perhaps even more remarkably, would join now. And given the crisis, you have to wonder who they are as well. But seriously, I've argued tonight that the consequences of ruling out Euro membership in this way could be far-reaching and far from Britain's national interests. The views on a referendum are more balanced, with 56 favouring one and 44% regarding it as a distraction at this time. These views suggest people like me have a mountain to climb if we are going to change public minds. But my optimism comes from the almost 7 in 10 people in Britain who cannot imagine a future for Britain without close cooperation with our fellow Europeans. 7 out of 10. The 50% of Britons who would support further integration if they could be convinced that this would strengthen Britain's influence. This group of us who lean instinctively towards Europe need to understand and debate how the terms of being in Europe may be about to change. And I believe there is more to play for. So let me just say this to you in conclusion and try and summarise what I've been saying to you this evening. The uncontested analysis over the last year or two is that Europe is suffering a banking and sovereign debt crisis whose causes lie in part in a crisis of competitiveness and structural imbalances across the Eurozone. My argument tonight is that there is a fourth crisis facing the EU, which is one of political legitimacy. Nobody can or should doubt the political will amongst Europe's political elite for the Eurozone to survive. But the action that will be required to secure the Eurozone for the future is going to require a significant new step into closer integration in the Eurozone at a time when the EU is already suffering from a degree of integration fatigue, and when the underlying sense of European identity and solidarity is uncertain. While I think this can work economically, I believe for it to be politically sustainable, we need a much clearer public debate about why this should be so, and not just how further integration should take place. At the start of the 21st century, there is a strong case for a union of European states that is more than just a loose community of values and interests, and more than just a free trade area. But the precise scope of that community, the extent to which it is or aspires to become a genuine political union, is something that needs to be much more actively understood and therefore debated. Even if fiscal union is a destination that has been implicit but dormant in the whole concept of monetary union for two decades, this step needs a clear mandate following a clear debate. For those states such as Britain, who will for the foreseeable future remain outside any new core group, the challenge is different, but no less acute. Europe may be about to ask us to choose. For three decades, we have had the freedom to define the European project as we want to understand it on our terms, even in the knowledge that others in Europe had their own rather different versions of what was going on and what was being aspired to. We have pursued a strategy of width over depth that has sustained a concept of integration in Europe within, basically, our political comfort zone in Britain. That strategy may now be defunct. If we choose to stay outside this core, and because we will not join the euro anytime soon, then we must stay outside, then a part of Europe will have started a clear political journey without us. What are the implications for Britain if the citizens of this core grouping over time increasingly find themselves answering questions about their European identity, their European solidarity, more in the affirmative? It took a century or more for Americans to develop this sense of continental identity alongside their state identities. And they were pulled into it by institutional change as well as pushed by events. So the European version of that journey may stall. It may be abandoned. There must be a chance of either happening. But what I'm saying to you tonight is that it may not. It might actually succeed. And if it does not fail, then the implications for the UK will be far-reaching. And that's, in my view, what all of us in Britain need to start thinking about soon and very clearly. Thank you very much indeed.